Van Paul.
Ja. Akbar Ali Ade. I can see that there are people who do not understand this language. They continue to have their own conversations, and Momo is one of them.
Yeah.
Momo?
Yeah, I'm coming.
Yes, honorable members, and our presenters. Just close the door behind you and give it your back. Let me just remind the colleagues about the importance of this the responses from National Treasury that at the beginning I said this is part and parcel of the bedrock of our fiscal policy. At some point we spoke about the exit strategy in terms of the economic and financial crisis that almost every part of the world felt. Now, in the fiscal framework proposals and as adopted by Parliament, the projections in terms of SARFs and so on and so forth, to a very large extent depends on what we're deliberating into the future. That is at a macro level. At the micro level, millions of South Africans who are honest taxpayers are also seriously putting their hopes on us as the committee on behalf of Parliament, where they are going to apply our minds and exercise our responsibilities as expected in dealing with this very important subject. I'm saying so because you're going to deal with individuals and savings in terms of the summary of key issues. You also have got the interests of the country vis-a-vis the interests of business. And this is an interaction or the interaction between various stakeholders and National Treasury officials to a certain extent have managed to close gaps among themselves on these issues. We have heard about the implications of double taxation insofar as it also related to international cross-border issues. And the most important, or not the most important, and one of the most important aspects that is beginning to be factored into the tax base, which has not found a very, very clear expression, is the royalties. Obviously, the most complicated part of everything, we leave it to the tax administrators. That's the administration of whatever law we're going to put in place. And the efficacy part of it, which is very, very important for the taxpayer and also to the collectors of tax in the country. If the administration is not up to scratch, it leads to all sorts of complaints and other things, but also deficiencies in revenue collection. So I just thought, as we enter into deliberations of key issues, we should have this at the back of our minds, that this is not one of those pieces of legislation that we can afford to take for granted. The consequences will come back to haunt us as parliamentarians. Over to you, honorable members. I would not want to say this is the manner in which you are going to pose your questions. For clarity and comments, you have marked areas that you are interested in, and I would agree and probably pursue that we should handle it according to what each one of us has before him or herself, that you'd want comments and clarity from the presenters. Thank you. Over to you. I'll start to my extreme right, Honorable Yenge, followed by Honorable Madlamini, Honorable Dion George, and Honorable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Chair. It's on. Yeah, thank you, Chair. Mine is on, let me first commend the presenter for the explicit mechanism that has been used to put us on board as this portfolio committee. The question that I would pose is on page, in fact, it's 2.8 on page 10, is on retirement, the conversion of retirement proceedings into lump sums. So I just want to get more elaboration on that as contained in section, in clauses 77, 78, paragraph 3 and 3A in the second circular. The layman's interpretation, if I may ask, so that I need more clarification on that. Then, out of the 60 comments that were received from the public, what was the majority of the what was the major feelings of the public in relation to this amendment? Was it positive or negative, or else the In fact, further than that, the involvement of that public was it actually done in the initial stages of the amendment or in the actual formulation? On international, those are local issues. On international, Chair, there are cities, there are foreigners who have actually acquired the citizenship of the country. What is the status of them in relation to taxation? Is it the same with the locals? Further than that, if a foreigner is married to a local, is that particular person regarded as one who has acquired citizenship, or in fact, if that marriage is in community of property, then do you divorce the foreigner from the local? Then lastly, Chair, is the issue on the on administration. A problem statement has actually been put forward. Is there any hypothetical view that has been crafted in response to the problem statement? That is the hypothetical view, I mean, a view that still needs to be engaged on by the public and the department. On cost implications, has cost implications been considered in the actual formulation of the bill?
Thank you, Chair. I think I must also follow a colleague of mine by saying thank you to the National Treasury. We are aware that it took so much of your time and the effort and the consultation to come out with this proposal. My first concern is on page 6, under individuals and savings, key person insurance plans. Bullet number 2. Taxpayers can cede the plan before maturity to creditors while continuing to pay on the policy. Now, I just need a clarity here. Here am I, and I've been paying my premiums on monthly basis. And for some other reason, firstly, the company may become not liquidated as such, or terminate some of its functions, which maybe I was the part of, or my position was allocated to those functions, and I get retrenched. And by that time, the insurance is not matured. Who continue pay my part? Because I'm an employed now. I'm an employed person. What happened to the company? Has the company provided within that product of the insurance? Was there any provision that should that happen, they will continue paying so much percentage to ensure that the benefits thereof, I receive it at that first agreement or initial agreement. If then not, then what do the company do? Do the company say, Suzanne Dlamini, now that you are retrenched, and the insurance says it's a paid up insurance, but you're not going to pay you now, we'll pay you at the age of 65. Now, if then that is the case, What savings do I have there? What savings do I have as an individual? Do I have savings there? Who benefits? Because to me, it's like it's still the employer that benefits than the employee. I just need that clarity. Then, page 8. Mismatches. This ongoing use of dividend cession to undermine the tax base. You know, Melissa Comrade Mumu, Chief, if you look at our economy, we are saying, we are patting ourselves at the shoulders and saying we have tried. But I am not too sure as to how far we have tried if we started our financial year at 1.9 trillion, which is a deficit. And we are still having this mismatch that are floating around. And that's where, in fact, our port is. That's where we're supposed to receive the money. That's where we're supposed to ensure that our country is well sustainable. Now, and the Treasury, I understand the dilemma, but you are specialists. We believe you can do it. I don't see a reason why a shareholder, when it comes to the dividend, then it gets treated differently. Because now if there are, whether those are preferential shares or the ordinary shares, at the end of the day, they will somehow generate the money for you. So why, as government, are we not getting something out of that? And it's the big companies that are doing that. So I am saying, and I am requesting through you, Chair, I know it's difficult, but let's try and do something. Even if it means we get other people to actually help us with this mismatch, because that's where we're losing the money. Let's try and expedite this, because that's where we are losing the money. I agree with the Treasury on page 9. Under liquidating residential properties. I totally agree with you. You are right. We can't go on with this because initially when it was done to escape or to undermine the tax base. Yeah. So I agree with I agree with that proposal. Argument for and against, page 12. Wow. Bullet 2, neutral between domestic and foreign debt. Foreign owners and domestic. This is a serious problem. But I'm not too sure if the National Treasury will try and sort this problem alone. It's a collective effort here. We need to bring the trade on board. We need to bring other departments on board. Because these streets are a serious problem. If you look at the indicators of economy and you look where we were actually getting the money, you will see that manufacturing was one of them, clothing was one of them. But because of these streets that we have gone out and we put them on place, they are creating so much problem. So we still have to work on that. And I will then propose that I'm sure the committee will be very much excited, even if you go just before our medium-term budget statement, that we get some sense of saying, you know, the train has started moving, even if it hasn't reached the destiny, because it is a serious problem. Page 16, rollover relief. First bullet, the sale triggers a royalty that is subject to a notional upliftment because many small and medium-sized extractors lack the means to bring the mineral resource to required minimal level. You know, respected expertise, why you see the ANC youth league making so much noise about, not noise as such, making so much debate about nationalization, it's because of the act that is not straight. You can't tell me that when you look at the 2007, the tax that we scoop from the minerals, it was about 32 billion. 32 billion something, something. Fortunately, I look at this yesterday. And you look at how much the mines alone have generated thus far. It goes up to 400 trillion. And then you only get the tax of 32,000 billion. And the shareholders, maybe there are 10, maybe there are 5, I don't know, they get about something like 25,000 billion. Which are trillions at the end of the day. Now, when we talk about the wealth of the country, you know, the commodity of height, you know, those commanding height of economy being shared by the whole. People don't want, people are not saying we want to own the mines. People are saying out of what is being extracted, let us get something out of it. Now, the National Treasury is still having a problem to identify the factors between the extraction itself and the refining as to what can you use so as to be able to get more money there. We are not going to get them. We're not going to get anything from the extraction because that's not where the money is. The money is when what we have extracted from our soil, beneath our soil, when it gets into those ships and it goes outside to be refined. And that's where we're supposed to get the money. But now at the end of the day, my worry is we are sitting here, all of us, irrespective of whether the DA or ANC, representing the people of South Africa. They sit, they come from that soil, they own that soil, that's where they're coming from. Something is being extracted and they don't become the beneficiaries of what is being extracted. So I am saying to the department, we can do far better when it comes to the minerals, especially the minerals. Coal, yes, we are the first one, or if not the second one, that is extracting it. But there are others. There are about 55 of those minerals that we are extracting. What is happening? What is happening? And when it comes to the gold, I'm sure we are the second one or the first one too. But when those that are putting the earrings, they will tell you the price of those earrings, how much are they? But if they were mined at the front and being taken overseas, and they come back with the triple price. And we are saying SARS tax can do something far better. Even if we can't get it then, because of whatever reason, but I think the department can do far better through the act and make sure that we are getting something as a country. Because through that, then the economy of our people, of our country, will help. I don't say that minerals are the highest, but I know that they contribute about 7.7, but out of that we can get far better than the 32 trillion. Thank you, Chair.
I just want to make an appeal to honorable members because the presentation is quite long. It covers quite a number of sections that our input should be direct to the point so that we don't run into serious problems of time. And those who want to have a second bite can have a second bite later.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will be directed to the point, but I can't resist responding on the nationalisation. I think that it'd be a very interesting debate going forward, and I don't share all of the sentiments that were actually put on the table today. Thank you. Slide number 11, on the continuation option on the key person insurance, my understanding that this insurance is life insurance only, and that at some point this policy may be ceded to the employee. Now, I just want clarity whether this is on retirement only or also on other circumstances, because in theory, key insurance means that that person is a key person and you wouldn't want to lose them in any other circumstances other than retirement. So if this applies to withdrawal, then should it be that way? Then on slide number 6, where there's reference to the employer being jointly liable for errors on the private use assumption, I'm not quite sure what that means, if you could just maybe explain that. And then there was mention of the tax, the tax that was imposed by Brazil and China on the mobile capital. I know that that is not a proposal at the moment, but it would be interesting to know whether it was successful in its objective, i.e. to keep the money for a longer term in the country or maybe to prevent it from coming at all. And then on slide number 28, the renegotiation of the treaties, I think the question is just that, why is it necessary that we need to renegotiate them? Didn't we get them right the first time, or has there been a fundamental change? And then finally, on the document that we received, this one, the draft response document from National Treasury, on page number 29, there's reference to transfer pricing. Now, we all know that transfer pricing is a major tax evasion mechanism and that these need to be tightened up, but the effective date is moved to October 2011 because there's certain things that SARS needs to do. Our question is quite simply, why October 2011? Is it not possible to do it earlier? Is there that much that SARS actually has to do? Thank you, Chair.
Yes.
Another one.
No, it's you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I shall speak as long as Mr. Leonardo Lamini did. Just kidding.
Well,
it's
not
going to respond. But let me take just, if I can just have a note of discord from your statement, Mr. Chairman, in to the extent that it created just a position between the country and business. I think that should it's a sentiment that one would not wish to echo. But and then I also join in gratitude for the presentation received, which was completed and shows that there has been a great acceptance of public comments. Now, my questions of comments, I think were quite clear. Going back to the key person insurance plan, I'm personally thankful that my original comment of avoiding to shut the gate and getting people crashed underneath has been taken into account. I was proposing a grandfathering. You're suggesting now a cession without tax consequences. I think that that's a very good approach for as long as it is without tax consequence, and the tax consequences are only going forward without any retroactivity. It seems that there has been a fairness. Thank you. Then on page 8, the on the mismatch problem, if I understood it correctly, what you're utilizing here, it's a presumption against the taxpayer. And if I understand correctly, I find it quite repugnant. So there is a presumption, and the taxpayer need to rebut that presumption by means of satisfying a tracing requirement, if I understood it correctly. That I don't think that is fair vis-à-vis the taxpayer. There was another issue which I've not been able to trace in the presentation. I don't know whether it's been settled elsewhere or otherwise, which was raised in one of the presentations from the Institute of Chartered Accountants on the differentiation of treatment between the interest paid to a bank which are deductible and the interest paid to my mother who lent me money which are not deductible, and which also raises issues in terms of equality of treatment. And I want to know whether that has been settled, and if not, why not? There was a throwaway line that Mr. Hengel gave us that I would wish, if you were so inclined, to expand for us. When when discussing the arguments for and against the on page 12, the first slide, it said that one of the issues is that banks do not pay taxes on their interest. So if you can tell us why banks don't pay taxes, would be educational for me at least. Then the, let me just see what else, and I'm trying to be short, I'll not make true on my threat. But there is a last point that I want to raise for my own sake or for my own conscience, as controversial as it might be. At the end of the presentation, forgive me, I forgot your name, sir. Mr. Morgan, sorry, my apology. I remember my communist background makes Hengel's name much more easy to remember. But the dealing with the CO2 emissions, you stated all the research that we have done indicates that this is the right state. Now, I would like to acquire that research. For the sake of me, nobody's talking about global warming anymore. We talk about climate change and the connection between CO2 emissions and climate change in a world which is becoming colder and colder has not been established or revealed to me. So if there is such connection, and I understand the train has now moved in this direction, facts no longer matter, but the this to me seems as a disguised luxury tax. We tax it because we can. We tax because there is a new generation of products which needs to be subsidized by making the old products less economically viable, and therefore we go ahead and doing it. And now, from a point of view of taxpayers, I think we need to satisfy at least in this venue the burden of showing that there is a provable connection between the vague notion of climate change and putting less carbon dioxide in the sky. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think those are the few comments, but perhaps before you respond, let me also add mine, and we'll have another round of comments and clarifications, probably. I think in terms of the royalties, I agree with my colleagues, but I don't think in this proposed taxation amendment bill will cover everything, because some of these issues are more residing on the Mineral and Resources Development Act. I think that's where most of the issues, which will then enable National Treasury through SARS to actually do more work around those issues. So I thought I should just make this observation. And obviously, I think what will be also more important in that Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act is to look into issues of strategic minerals. What is our approach and vision as a country on those issues, like platinum, which is not found anywhere in the world except in South Africa, part of it in Russia and Zimbabwe. What is our view? But the other thing that I thought I should raise in terms of the, I think is the bracketing, you know, the definition of beneficiation. Sometimes we fall into the trap of classifying processing as beneficiation, because even if you put a smelter, that is not beneficiation, it's part of processing of raw materials. But it's also part of the discussion that is located elsewhere. What I'm more interested at that level is the fabrication, which is more value add and research and development and the resources that goes into that, and job creation. That will help us to deal with the issue of taxation as we move forward. The one issue that I thought I should also reflect on is on page 19. And I'm sure Momo and others would remember the attitude of the police before the new dispensation. In the middle of the night, Momo might have gone through this. You'll have to look for your trousers. You'll be asking your girlfriend or your wife, where's my trousers? Because they have arrived at Latham Sloop. Now, this revised proposal, it reminds me of that. I know there's been a discussion around this matter. You know, the tax practitioners out there, and specialists and professors, have been talking about this matter. The original proposal and the problem around who bears the responsibility of over or under taxation at the level of an individual, even if it's a company. The position of SARS says pay now and query later. Now, the proposal as it stands, the revised proposal, it says instead of completely deleting the discretion, it will be narrowed to cater for circumstances outside a taxpayer's control, as the case in the VAT Act. I'm not very sure what the VAT Act says, because it would be important to understand minimally what are we talking about. And when I said during those days, when they arrive, they say, yourself weren't too proud. Whether it is you or it's your brother that they are looking for, just to clarify that it's not me, it's my brother who's not here. You'll clarify that in the cell, that it was not you. Now, I think the determination of what is outside the taxpayer's control is very, very critical. So I thought I should just mention this part. Yeah, those are the two comments, basically. But the most important one is the last one. What are the benchmarks of this clarification? Because you don't want to find people trapped in this thing and there's an argument. What is outside the taxpayer's control, you know?
Okay, I think, you know, we'll respond in detail to all the questions. But just to make, you know, a few general points, and I know some of them are obvious. I mean, you know, the amount of revenue that any state raises is at the heart of whether you are an effective state or not, and whether you have the power to do what you want to do as a country and reduce your our dependency. I think that, you know, in tax policy one's made all kinds of decisions, and as you know, the tax process, once in every 15 or 20 years you have a major commission, they review the tax policies, as you had the tax advisory committee that Professor Katz chaired. So arising from that, one takes an approach towards, you know, corporate tax, personal income tax, VAT, etc. And one also has to take into account how competitive we are as an economy. You can tax somebody very high, but if that means that investors don't come, there's no point in having a high tax. And I think it's very important that even with businesses, we seem to have a climate that's certain, that we're not changing the rules. And particularly when you look at areas like mining, there are huge investments that people put in. Once they're putting the investments, if government starts, you know, changing its mind on major issues, it does have implications, I think, on the investment climate. So, and then, of course, with tax as well, there's a trade-off between leisure and trade. People, individuals may feel if the tax is too high that it's not worth working. You'd rather not earn that money. And most importantly, just to be realistic, the higher your tax rates, the more people avoid it and evade it. And so one's got to be realistic about what's the capacity of the state to administer. And I think whatever we decide on policy, at the end of the day, if SARS as a tax collection agency can't do something, it becomes theoretical about whether we should do something. Just with regard to the process, I think that we've embarked on, to answer the question, the public comments come as soon as we've published the bill, and the comments come thereafter. Some people come sooner, but some people obviously wait till the deadline, which was 11th of June, and some people focus on when Parliament had its hearings, when people were invited to come and make comments. What you have today and the bills that we will present, then, so their comments are based on the draft bill that we publish on the 11th of May. What you have today is we're saying how we're going to respond to those comments. And I see this year, Keith, we've omitted to put just a list of from whom we've received comments.
No,
Is it in?
We'll make sure that some response out.
Okay.
There are 60 organizations. And
so we even say who's given comments.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
We kept them
separate. Yeah. And so what the committee decides today after our presentations will lay the basis for the revisions to the bill that was published on the 11th of May. With regard to the costs, you know, it's the nature of tax that, you know, it's sometimes you don't cost everything. I mean, the biggest amount of revenue that comes in is obviously at the rates that you set. To the extent that you have deductions, they obviously take away the amount that you could have collected. But you have those deductions because you want to promote certain behavior. So, and tax is often used either to raise revenue or to promote certain behavior. In the case of the environment, we have a carbon tax to discourage use of carbon. And obviously, the primary motive for most of the taxes is to raise revenue. Now, once you have the rates, that kind of sets largely the amounts that will come through. With regard to deductions, we can cost some of them, and we do cost them when we can, but sometimes these things are still going to take effect, so it's hard to get exact numbers because it depends on the take-up. But certainly it's also an area that, Chair, even as a future reform, tomorrow you are having a hearing on the tax statistics. We've kind of tried to make sure that we, you know, in the tax system there's a lot of information, that we publish that information. We still have to publish a lot more, but it's an incremental process of improving. So, say, measuring the amount of tax incentives, the tax expenditures, is quite an important objective that we want to start doing, hopefully next year, publishing these numbers. But yes, we do take into account the costs. Some are more accurate than others. We don't always get it right because it also depends on where you are in the economic cycle. So sometimes maybe our revenue targets are too low, as they prove to be, or sometimes when you have a decline, they tend to be too high. So there's a lot of factors that will impact on it, and hence we also tend to revise the numbers when it comes to the medium-term expenditure statement that we do mid-year. Just with regard to, I think, some of the issues raised on the mining side, I think that we should bear in mind that generally we tax profit when it comes to corporates. Yes, there are other taxes that are linked, whether it's capital gains and so on, but generally we tax profit. But over and above that, in the mining sector, through the mining legislation, we have decided to tax royalties. That took effect, was going to take effect last year, 1st of March 2009, but because of the state of the economy, we delayed it to this year, and it's already yielding a lot of revenue. And I think, you know, the question of whether you should tax more or less, you know, when you're in a commodity boom, the numbers obviously look very large, but when there's a decline, the numbers can look different. And different minerals have different costs. So if you look at gold, because we're no longer the biggest producers of gold, we are now number three or number four, because we have to dig deeper to get our gold. So they're more expensive Yes, platinum is a different story, but each metal has its own story, and I think that it's on the one hand, we need to balance different objectives of investment certainty, and certainly, you know, we can make available, and it will be in the document that you have, to some extent indicates how much we collect from different sectors. Whether that's appropriate level certainly can be discussed and should be discussed, but I believe that we do have the mechanisms where these areas are being taxed appropriately currently, just given the different legislative objectives that we've had. But Cecil will answer this in more detail, but I wanted to just make the point. Whether we succeed in beneficiation or not also depends on how competitive we are. For example, when we did the growth study last year, or year before last, the point was made that on each metal one has to look at the case and see what the skill set are in our country, what the costs are. And whilst we want people to beneficiate because it will create jobs, one's got to have a lot of those factors aligned. And we are quite dependent on our export proceeds from just exporting our minerals. So one needs to take into account a lot of other considerations when determining an approach to various issues. Cecil will come and deal with the specific issues, Chair, that you've raised, but I agree with you that the broader issues, I think one does need the Department of Mineral Resources involved, because a lot of it was driven by the approach that they took with their legislation. And so on. Just on the last point, with regard to the environment, I think, you know, one can take an approach, and I would differ with the Honourable Member. I think that the scientific evidence is pretty strong, but like on HIV/AIDS, one can decide it exists or it doesn't exist. But certainly as government, we've committed to that policy, and papers are available, like the long-term mitigation scenario. And again, that's driven by the position that government's taken. And once government's taken that position, it's very clear that the tax system must support the position that government has taken. The president has gone out, he's committed South Africa to various targets. And I would differ with the honourable member to say it's getting colder. We must differentiate between everyday temperatures and average climate trends, but one can have a long discussion on that. But to that extent, again, I would say if you want to debate issues on that policy, I think one needs to also bring the relevant department, like environmental affairs, for discussion. But they have driven the policy, and I personally think that's the correct policy. And yes, the Treasury has published papers in the past, and we are about to publish further papers, so we're quite happy to make our research available. I think it's still important to put these research papers out in the public domain, but to the extent that we'll collect existing papers and the coming papers, we'd certainly make them available when we publish them, but provide some of the current papers that government has already produced. Maybe let's just get to the specifics then. I think there was a lot of questions on the key man insurance. I think, Keith, you just need to explain, because I think there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding on that. So perhaps let's just start with that.
The key one, the key person insurance is always confusing. And the problem is this is a specific kind. But there are two kinds of insurance. There's a kind of insurance that when you join a company, you get, and then there's key person insurance. Now, basically, the rules are when you get your insurance part of a group plan, that on that plan, that when the employer gets a deduction, basically, you have an inclusion equal to the premium. That's the general rule. Sometimes the employer will work it out so that the employer loses the deduction, but then you don't have income. So there's just sort of two standard ways of doing it. You can either have a deduction up front for the employer and he has income, or there's no deduction, no income. But those are the standard plans where they're for the benefit of the employee. Now, I believe, and this one I'm not so sure about, is if that's the situation that you're worried about. I mean, if you go out and you join a company, the company offers you insurance, you want to know at age 50 or 55, that if I leave the company, can I keep paying on the insurance? That I'm not so sure, but I believe that's the way it should work. I can't see why it doesn't. The tax law has nothing to do with that. But that's the way it should generally work, and then you should be able to carry on paying. Some companies do, some companies don't in that regard. But that's the basic rule. So what we're worried about here with the key person plan is that you're trying to disguise it as something else. So that what you're really doing is trying to help the employee and you're trying to get around the tax rules. Now the tax rules say there's got to be a matching principle. But if you have to take out a key plan for the benefit of the company, when that happens, the company, you as an employee, are not supposed to get the benefit because that's a different plan. If you want a plan for your benefit, then that's under one regime. Okay. What basically happens in a key person plan is this. If what the company does is says, look, I've got 100 employees, but there are three guys that I really need. And like my sales rep, if I lose my sales rep, I'm going to lose 20% of my client base. So the insurance that the employer takes out, it says, the employer says, if I lose this employee, then I will get maybe 100,000 Rand upon his departure in order to cover me for the lost clients or the lost contacts or whatever will happen to my business. It might take me three people to replace that person. So the key person plan is to protect the company. That's what it's for. It's not the situation that you're worried about. However, some people have tried to disguise a plan as a key plan when it's really for the benefit of the employee. Yeah. So it's a game they're playing. If they want to benefit you, they should go forward and have a escape group plan. Done. But they don't like the tax consequences of doing it that way. They want to play a little game where they want to make sure that they undermine the tax base. So they pretend that the plan is really for the benefit of the employer. And then last minute, when the payout comes, they suddenly give the money to you. And that way, under current law, they get a tax benefit, where the employer gets a deduction up front and the employee only has income later on. That's what we're trying to close down. We're trying to say, look, if we need to help you, that's fine, but we need to play the rules straight. And the rules straight are, I, the employer, gets a deduction, you have fringe benefit income. Or I get no deduction, you have no income. I can choose it either way. So you can do it either way, but that's the game playing it up straight. There should be a parity, deduction, income, or nothing, nothing. But what the game was before was to say it's really for something else. The employer gets a deduction, you have no income, and then later on you get the benefit. That's what we're trying to close down. So, but there is issues around, however, that said, if the employer has created such a plan and you do leave the company, you can take the plan with you, but you have to keep paying on it. And that's generally what happens. If you leave the company, you're the one who's going to keep paying. So it's but this is not what your concerns are. This is really a different kind of game. Okay. But and the other one, it is important on that side. Okay, the other one, too, that seems to, and again, I'm glad that it was appreciated, the issue on the sessions. I note the member, honorable member, noting that. We salute you for that. And we were thinking on that side, so we were being listened to. And then the other issue is that was issued on retirement. You had some concerns about the retirement issues. First thing, again, that goes back to Momo's point that when we did these amendments, we have two sets of consultation. The consultation that he was referring to is after the bill is released. Before a bill is released, we also do a fair amount of consultation. In the area of retirement, we consult very closely with the Institute of Retirement Funds, the Pension Lawyers Association, and a few others. What the real issues were trying to help the taxpayers here. What happens in the world of retirement is you have your straight annuities, where you receive, and then you also have this lump sum. And the lump sum it's basically treated beneficially. So a lump sum up to $300,000 is exempt, the rates are better and all of that. Under current law, the lump sum benefits only apply if you get a lump sum on retirement. But sometimes, as time goes along, you'll have two things when you retire. You get a lump sum of cash, and hopefully you use that cash to pay off your debts, or to invest, or buy a house, or do something like that, and not throw the money away. Unfortunately, a lot of people do waste their money on lump sum, which is a problem. Then the second, that's one-third. That's the one-third, two-thirds. It could be other formulas. I'm just saying the general rule. Then the other two-thirds is an annuity stream. So that's for your own benefit. To make sure you protect yourself against yourself. Because sometimes we are our own worst enemies. I can attest to that. So the point is, one-third you get cash up front, and then you get an annuity. Sometimes that annuity can be converted into a lump sum also. And that will typically happen when you're getting an annuity, and then the annuity amount starts getting very small, and you start looking at the bill, and you see the insurance company is making more money off your annuity than you are. At that point, we let you convert and take out the whole amount of money. The laws around that subsequent conversion were very unclear. And what we basically said is that kind of conversion will also get the same benefit, whether you as a retiree get it or you give the annuity to your spouse and she converts it. That was the bulk of those amendments. And that's all that's going on there. I don't know if you want to jump in for something and I can go back. I have just two other issues.
Okay,
yep. The other issues that are there are on the real one is the mismatch schemes. We do appreciate that. I think your points on the mismatch scheme are well taken. What you're talking about is this. In the tax system, it's about there's two elements to it. And when you look at the income tax has a redistributive element. It says if you make 100 Rand, well, you'll be taxed on 100 Rand. If somebody is very rich and they make 10 million a year, they should be taxed on 10 million. That is the redistributive element of the tax system. You tax the people who have the money. They do receive more benefits from the society. And so when you find that you have a gap in the tax system, a company that's making 100 million is really pretending it's only making 40 million or 10 million, you have a problem. And the difficulty is the richer you are, the more options you have. Money breeds money. Money breeds friends. Money breeds a lot of good things. And one thing the money does is it allows you to hire expensive lawyers like myself to manipulate the tax system and undermine it. And what you get very worried about from a fiscus point of view is... I work for National Treasury. But if I go to the other side, if I go to the dark side, you don't want that. So you want to make sure that everybody pays their fair share. The difficulty is if you've done this planning right, you've got it so well skilled that it's very difficult to attack it head on without affecting something that government doesn't want to affect. So it's easy to go after anti-avoidance, but if you don't do it right, you're going to have unintended consequences. And so here we've had to hold back a little bit for unintended consequences. And the problem with dividends is as follows. On the one hand, the more money you make, the more you should be taxed. Dividends have a special rule. And it's a complicated special rule, but basically, dividends should only be taxed once. So if they go through the system a million times, they should only be taxed once. And that's by the original company making the payment as a general rule. These dividends have already been taxed once at 10%. Now somebody else is picking them up tax-free. And there are reasons why we have that rule, but that rule doesn't always make sense, and that's really what the problem is here. There are two sets of rules clashing, and if we're going to deal with that, we're going to have to deal with it head on, and we're going to have to really go back, and we just can't do that in a week, and then we'll get a whole bunch of other adverse consequences. Then there were some issues about the 11A deduction, the interest deduction, about parity. You can get an interest deduction no matter who you are, whether you're a bank or whatever, if you pay out interest, as long as it's for a productive purpose. So if you want to give money to your mom to do a business and it's part of your production of income, it's okay. But if you give out business for personal loans, you know, if you give out personal loans, you don't get a deduction. The income tax does not allow you getting a deduction for consumption because that's your wealth. If you're going to spend it, you don't get a deduction for a vacation, nor should you give it for giving it to your kids. So that's the distinction. But moms, everybody has an equal right to a deduction for interest as long as it's a production of income purpose. Then there was one comment that I said as a side that you picked up, and that was those banks. Now, I didn't say the banks weren't paying their effective rate. It was the taxpayers. They were saying, look, the guys offshore are getting an exemption, and the local guys are not being taxed as much as they should, so they're only playing a parity. Look, banks are being taxed, The question is, are they paying the effective rate they should? Now, gradually, with the efforts of SARS, the bank rate is increasing. But you see around the world, it's hard to tax banks and other financial institutions because they have the easiest money to move around. And there is always a challenge about how much you do want to tax banks, and that even gets down to the basic fundamental issue. The more you tax the banks, the more you raise the cost of funding. So every time we go, there's always a counter push. And so you've got to balance that. But I think we have been trying very hard to make sure that everybody pays a reasonable effective rate. I don't mean to pick out the banks in particular. I'm just, the argument I raised is on behalf of other people, why they were arguing something there. I think that's essentially the main issues I would have.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, good.
I'll pick up a few issues, and I think Franz will come in on a few other issues. Just to pick up something Dr. George mentioned on the Brazil and China example, that is, in our case, still work under progress. We haven't got a proposal of that nature. There is a lot of discussion in this morning's paper as talk about the ruling party considering that. This is being also considered within the Treasury. And we will obviously do some decent work. It's not only Brazil and China, it's also Chile, Colombia. There's quite a number of countries that historically have that particular instrument in place. And that is an instrument that has been used to try and deal with the impact of the carry trade on the exchange rate, which is important for policy principle. So we will probably come back to the committee early next year and see how Treasury moves on that particular issue. On the issue of royalties, I think we have made an important step in, as Momo has said, the mines do pay their normal corporate profits, and we've got a regime. And in addition to that, the changes by the MPRDA and the changes of mineral rights has allowed us to have a much broader base of royalties. Previously, we had lots of lease payments. It was very patchy. And now we've consolidated all of that into a royalty structure, which I think is very well designed, and it also takes into account the commodity cycle. So our royalty is not a fixed royalty, and as the commodity cycle increases, the profitability of the mines increases, the royalty rate increases. So we do get some on the upside. But also equally, mines and commodity cycle is fluctuate, and so what we've built into is that when mines become marginal, and there's a threat that they might close down because of a drop in the commodity cycle, the rate also comes down. So I think we have the mechanism to have a royalty regime that is very flexible and allows the state to get a fair share in times of commodity booms. We can play around with the rate still and see whether the overall rate is reasonable, but that I think is for a following up debate. We will only be able to monitor the revenue that we get over the next 18 months. As Momo has said, the first payment came through in June, and you'll see there is some money coming into the system, which I think, if we fine-tune it, it can be a very robust, fair share that government takes out of the system. We will not go into the debate of nationalization and things like that, because that's not a Treasury issue. We make sure that we get a fair share from the resources that's extracted from the mineral. Doesn't matter who owns it. And Mr. Chair, it also links with the beneficiation because the royalty is intended primarily to compensate government for the loss of the resource. Mm. So you don't want to tax the beneficiation, you actually want to encourage beneficiation, and that's the fine balance that you have to draw there. On the issue of, just to comment on a key issue, Dr. Ambrosini, on the interest by banks and your mother and things like that, we actually withdraw that proposal. So that proposal is the one that was intended to encourage savings, and because of the distortion that you've mentioned, we withdraw that proposal. But we are looking at whether that provision is in itself a sustainable provision. So
your mother can still lend you money.
I think those are the issues, and maybe just touch on the issues that Momo's also touched. Look, we're not the experts on the environment. We don't pretend to be. We've done some work on environmental economics where the tax system links up, and I think there is some important role for the tax system to play. Mr. Chair, it would be a good idea if you asked the Department of Environmental Affairs maybe to brief the committee on the work they've been doing on climate change and the role that government is taking place in the negotiation process. And I think that's important because we are hosting the next big event next year. There's all of these negotiations taking place. There was Copenhagen last year. The end of this year, it's Mexico. And in 2011, where the real deal has to be struck.
After the American election.
It will be hosted in South Africa. So South Africa will be a very key player for the next round of negotiation around Kyoto. But that is really an expertise that lies somewhere else. But as Momo said, we can provide you with all the documentation that we have. There's lots of it. And one can read on these things at infinitum. I think that's from my side. Franz, would you want to kick on that other stuff?
Maybe before Franz comes to this. Just on the royalty and the link to the commodity cycle, that it is responsive. In your submissions earlier on, in terms of the challenges of undermining tax base, one of the key elements that you alluded to was that debt works in the interest of shareholders as opposed to equity. I think for as long as you don't have other motives later on that will actually begin to reflect, even in the commodity boom cycle, that your profit is not as good as the markets are actually supposed to say. In other words, you may find that equity in the company is always less than debt, so that your profit becomes less and less in terms of your royalty taxation.
We've taken that in account in the design. So when you work out the profitability to calculate the rate, we don't allow interest as a deduction. So we take EBIT before interest, and that's precisely the reason why we've done that.
Just add one point. I mean, that's exactly. Royalty is a much narrower base. The base is gross. You cannot play around with that the way you can with the income tax because you're not measuring the overall wealth of the company. Therefore, you don't have to take into account the overall subtractions. So it helps, and that's one of the very contentious aspects of the royalty, that we've narrowed the base to get rid of a lot of that stuff. So he's absolutely right.
Broaden the base.
Well, we've sort of, yeah, okay, whatever. We get. The other issue is just on one point about beneficiation here. One of the things, too, is that the royalty tries not to tax beneficiation, like you're talking about the real beneficiation. But even semi-beneficiation, you want to really tax the value of the mineral resource. Because you don't want to add a charge for adding value, because then you discourage it. And that was in the basic design that was done. So that was actually a number of reasons why we made concessions and adjustments, specifically to make sure that we're not taxing the value add extra. You only want to tax the mineral extra. But if you overtax the added value, people say, well, just take it offshore. And that's what I think Momo was referring to. So you've got to be reasonable in what you're doing.
Sorry. Yeah, just on this one, and I think not only this committee, you'll find this interest in all the committees because it's an economic issue. And I would want to link this thing to what Momo raised earlier on. In terms of the higher your interest rates and the higher your taxes and so on and so forth, the more negative response you may get in terms of investment inward flow. But I want to ask and check what is your take on the Treasury's position of Australia in terms of the taxation of almost super profits. And
just link that to the actual performance of the mining sector in that country and the difference that it has been making in relation to ourselves. Because I think the treasury in that country has come out very bold on this issue. And I still have to see somebody saying Rio Tinto is running away and all those kind of things.
Let's settle this one, but we must remember they've lost the Prime Minister in the process. But,
Mr. Chair, when we look at our royalty, and we had the fortune that we could look at quite a lot of regimes around the world, we looked at the Australian one, and one of the problems that Australia had, they've got two issues. One, they've got much more power to their provinces. And so they have got royalties at the provincial level and at the federal level also.
Yeah. They call them states.
Yeah. And one of the big problems with a lot of the royalties in other parts of the world is that it's a specific royalty. So you say 5% or 3%, and it's 3% of a particular base. And that is where a lot of countries is lost out. Because the royalty is fixed, as the profitability of the company goes up, you're not getting the benefit of the super profits. What we've done with the formula, we've tried to build that into the system. So as the companies become more profitable, the rates come up. Although we've put a cap on it, the question is, those cap, is the cap reasonable? And probably people can argue maybe the cap is too low, and then we can up the cap. But it's in there. And also, the Australian system, what was it careful?
I'm getting a bit confused. I was following it, but I'm lost now. You are saying, as the company goes and try to make the profit, then you assess and increase the interest rates. No.
The royalty rates.
I mean the royalty rates. That's now how chair, because the minerals actually, when you look at their net profit, it's not being stimulated by the production as such. Because it's being stimulated, like what Momo said, it's a global, it's currency and the price, which is being determined globally, not by us.
The profitability of the mine is very much dependent on the commodity price. And so you'd find that as the commodity cycle moves positively and the price goes up, the mine becomes more profitable. Mm-hmm. It's in that case where our royalty rate goes up. But, Chair, maybe it would be a good opportunity at the next time. We will give you a short presentation on the royalty structure, because I think we did it to the previous committee.
Good.
The important thing to remember about the Australian one is the Australian super tax is much like our gold formula. It doesn't kick in immediately. There's a tunnel where it is tax-free, and only kicks in after a very high level of profitability. And don't look at the rate. Although the rate looks high, that base is very narrow. So one must be very careful when you compare things.
And can I just add, about 3 years ago, there was a proposal to look at a windfall tax in the liquid fuel industry, which, and it produced the whole paper, which you could also just make available to members.
Thank you. I think that leaves me to deal with some outstanding questions. There was a question about foreigners and citizenship and how it impacts the tax system. The tax system is completely neutral as to citizenship. The test on the tax system is twofold. It is, are you resident in this country? And we have two tests for that. The one is, are you ordinarily resident here? And then there's a days-based test. So once you've spent enough time in the country, whether you think you're ordinarily resident here or not, you are, as far as we are concerned.
And therefore you pay.
And therefore you pay tax on your worldwide income.
Yes.
There's a second test, which is, do you earn your money in South Africa? And to the extent, whether you are resident or not, that you earn money in South Africa, you are taxed in South Africa on it. So there are two levels to it. So that deals with a lot of questions. So there are a few countries around the world, there's a very small minority, the US happens to be one of those countries, that tax based on citizenship. And then they add residence and source, and so they just add an additional layer. We do not. We look at we follow the, what the majority of countries do, and we work on a resident source basis. As far as being married is concerned, we don't distinguish there either, typically. You are taxed in the income tax system as a person. We do not discriminate or differentiate based on whether you are married, single, have kids or don't have kids. That you are, as a person, are taxed. There are some concessions that exist for in things like donations tax, where you can transfer assets to your spouse. And then again, for our definition of what a spouse is, we're completely neutral. I mean, we try and leave. It doesn't have to be a heterosexual marriage between two people registered by and recognized by the state. We have a broader definition of what a spouse is. And equally, there's some anti-avoidance rules that trigger if you have a spouse and do transactions between spouses. So the tax system tries to be relatively neutral in this area. We're not going to sort of have anything turning on your citizenship, your marriage status, and so on, or at least very little. Then we had a question on the employers being liable for the errors in the pays you earn. Essentially, this is an existing situation that arises, and obviously what we need is some sort of control, because you can either have an 80% withholding, which would be appropriate for most people, but then, as industry has told us and the various employers, they do have a small subset of employees that literally spend most of their life on the road. I mean, your classic example is a sales rep. I mean, he spends way more time driving around from client to client than they ever do driving from the office to home and, you know, maybe on holiday. And so there, the percentage of private travel is a lot lower, very low, in fact. And so we consulted with people in the industry, and essentially what they said was a 20% cutoff was reasonable there. People there would tend to be under 20% private. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is that if the employer is comfortable that that employee is going to be traveling less than 20% on personal use and has a reasonable basis for that, that's fine. Then they can say, instead of charging 80%, we'll charge 20% withholding tax per month on the deemed percentage. Only 20% would be included. Now, what stops an employer from simply saying, well, that's fine, what's the problem? Everybody in this organization is going to use it for very little. Mm. And that's where the kicker comes in, because what we're saying is, if on audit we discover that you got it wrong, significantly wrong, and clearly we're not going to be excited about you being 1 or 2% out, but if we find that you've put someone who travels private 80% into the 20% bracket, well then, we can recover the underwithholding from you as an employer, and the potential for a penalty exists. And that's existing law. So we just bring that into the framework. And so that's what we're trying to achieve there. There was a question about renegotiating the treaties. The reason the treaties read the way they do is because our domestic law reads the way it does. So domestically, we exempted all interest. So preserving the right to tax interest in the treaties didn't make a lot of negotiating sense, because it's very difficult to argue with your negotiating partner, your treaty partner, and say, we'd like to reserve the right to tax interest, but we don't. Mm-hmm. So what's happened here is we've got a change in our paradigm. We're mm-hmm. saying, under some circumstances, we will want to tax the interest. And so the basis upon which those treaties were negotiated has shifted slightly, and so we're going to need to readdress them.
But I think the point we've taken to the extent that you know, it's a real slap to renegotiate. So we don't have any incentive to want to renegotiate. Also, I think if you look at the countries, many of them are so-called tax havens. And if you look at the G20, there's all kinds of other measures that have been taken internationally. But yeah, we will have to renegotiate.
Okay. An interjection. They all look like very nice places to go to for renegotiation.
We tend not to have too many treaties with tropical islands, but there are some that are islands that are quite cold and miserable, I understand, from people who've been there. So I hear some support. All right. Then the question around transfer pricing, why push it out until October next year? Just bear in mind that we already have transfer pricing provisions in, and essentially what we're doing here is we are broadening them somewhat, and we're changing the basis on the thin capitalization rules. Now, we already have both transfer pricing and thin cap rules. They're working, and what we're saying is they could be working better, and we need to align them better with what the international benchmark is. And having actually sat in some of the OECD discussions on the revisions to the various models and commentaries and so forth, this can be a pretty painstaking process because you want to get it right. And so I think October is reasonably challenging in its own right because we're going to have to release two new we're going to have to take two existing practice notes and rework them into two interpretation notes that will take the new framework into account. Now, we're going to be assisted, certainly, so it's not going to take us, I think it was the 3 or 4 odd years it took us to get those initial practice notes out, because we are closer to the international model now. But it's still going to be a bit of a challenge, and obviously we still have to go through a bit of a consultation process as well, because we're going to put a draft out of the interpretation notes, make sure that we are addressing people's concerns. And so that is all going to be adding on. So sounds like it's a year from now, but it's going to be a very busy year for my colleagues who are involved in the transfer pricing field. And then there was the final question that I think I have, which is, what are the circumstances outside of a taxpayer's control? Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, for those who really want all the details, I understand that we've released some guidance on the VAT aspect, which is out for public comment. So those who are interested can dig into that a little. But broadly, what we're thinking of here are things like serious illness, you had an accident that stopped you paying on time, maybe there was some kind of civil disturbance that stopped you paying, there might even have been some kind of natural disaster. So it's something that is truly outside of your day-to-day control. I can't say it was my accountant's fault, that is not a circumstance outside your control.
You are not
Peter Bob
from the
But, you know, the classic example is I was on my way to pay and I was knocked over by a car, you know, so I was then late. So that is outside your control, and we probably should be more sympathetic to you under those circumstances.
Well, I think, Treasury, you have coined the term unavoidable and unforeseen circumstances. Okay, I think, honorable members, unless there's additional issues that you'd want National Treasury to clarify, but at this point in time, I think you appear to have exhausted. Yeah, probably have exhausted each other. but just to say, in terms of process, let me just highlight some of the issues that have emerged in this deliberation. And I think you have indicated that it will be important that at some point we have a briefing on the royalty structure, which is quite important. A documentation around the windfall tax, either something like that. We are not very certain at this moment, but I think as the committee we may need to apply our minds on the treaties. It's quite important, given the changing circumstances and global, or tomorrow. It's pretty, okay, fine. Okay, it's a small session, but I think, yeah, this is more broader, this what I'm talking about. There's also an issue that we've touched on in relation to the mining sector, but I think it's a matter that it's a cross-cutting issue in terms of the economy, all sectors of the economy. I think at some point we need to debate or just to discuss and do an assessment, because it can be that since 1994 we have been talking about the mismatch of skills between the economy and the labor force. An assessment and sort of an evaluation as to how far are we in all the sectors of the economy in terms of the skills. I think we should know, should have that
database. It may not be resident in Treasury, but wherever it is important that we begin to know the limitations. As we speak about beneficiation, the royalties, and what we can do as a country in the mining sector, we say, let's also be mindful of what we can do and what we cannot do in terms of our skills. Recent economic statistics and analysis in the mineral sectors in the world does indicate that South Africa did not do as much as it could have done during the commodity cycles. And I want to assume it's not just about skills, also how we run our own administrative systems. How long does it take, you know, an investor to get a prospecting right in South Africa? 18 months sometimes, and so on and so forth. So it's not just issues of skills that we need to look into. It's a whole range, it's a package. So I thought I should just make this a few comments and ask from your side, Momo and your team, process-wise, what do you expect the committee to do from here? I think we have taken all our comments and the comments of others. What is now needed is for you to go and probably finalize this draft amendment bill, taxation bill, for formal tabling, so that we can be able to interact with it as the committee and take it forward. Mindful of the fact that this has been a very, very short year. We don't want to find ourselves running against time, because it does happen in other committees that departments come last hour, they pass this piece of legislation, otherwise I'm in trouble. And the committee says, no, we can't undermine public participation. We have to do our work as parliament. So I just wanted to be sure that we are on the same wavelength, same understanding, and same plank of moving forward in terms of this amendment. I'm aware that next year, as we table the budget, there will be other tax proposals, and these ones will then carry us through until the next financial year. But I think we need to find a way to begin to run with these processes as quickly as we can. Just from your point of view.
Our point of view now, what we do is, having heard these responses, we finalize this response document. But more importantly, we'll adjust the tax laws amendment bill, talk to the state law advisor, and then that will get tabled, hopefully, before the end of this month. And then you will look at it. I guess I shouldn't say this too loudly because it will mean more work for us. I guess at some point, although we've taken into account the public's comments, there is an issue of should people have a second bite at the cake, which your committee chair needs to look at. So I don't want to hide that issue under the table. But one hopes that we have taken most of the comments into account. And to the extent that I think there are harder issues, we take them for the future rather than deal with them this year. But so we table the bill, we hope, by the end of the month, and it would be the version that you would then adopt. But, of course, it's up to the committee then to decide the formal process thereafter.
Thank you. I therefore want to say to committee members that the second issue that we're supposed to deal with in terms of our progress, we'll defer it, and then we'll find an appropriate time during the course of this week to reflect on that matter, is the issue around the land bank, which we need to, it's not a very big issue, but I think we'll come back through the committee secretary here. Thank you very much. We are 30 minutes before time, so that is a sign of efficiency on our part. Thanks for your presentation, and I think you have handled all the questions very well, National Treasury. See you next time. Thank you.
Excuse me, sir. Good morning. I didn't catch your name. Are you on this list? Oh, okay. Then I'll remember.
Okay.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. From which...
I'm from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Okay.
That's right. I wanted to visit with your committee.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.